welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and welcome back, Paul. We've got Paul, and we're still chugging away or chipping away at this monumental document that was written by James Madison. And I say monumental because it's not very often that he really, you know, expresses himself to this level.
Right.
And so where we left off at this point, and oh, you know, by the way, folks, on Friday, I will be doing my special Christmas episode because it'll be the day before Christmas on broadcast day. And then I'll re-air that same broadcast if you care to enlighten the family and others regarding this thing we call Christmas and how it came to be in America. Mm-hmm. Gives you a historical perspective. And so anyway, in the last paragraph you read, which was 84, you brought up, you pointed out how Madison utilized the two words de jure de facto. And this is what he was speaking. He was saying, such is the political system of the U.S. de jure de facto. Now, what he's saying there in basic, in simplese, it is this de jure de facto is like a legal concept that is used to refer to what happens in reality or in practice as opposed to the law. And so today, when you hear people say de jure de facto, they are talking about what's happening in reality as what is the law. And they're confusing this. And they're basically looking, when you hear people talk about the de jure de facto U.S. government, what they're saying is they're saying that the government is legitimate. They're making the implications. This is why they say, well, we have to abandon the government. This is why we have to abandon the Constitution, because it is the problem. In other words, they're creating the association, the General Assembly, sovereign citizens, all the people that use this code word, de jure de facto. They're basically hoodwinking and saying, see, this whole thing is all a legitimate, a level of tyranny. And they're not actually challenging it. There's no way the federal government has the authority to do all these things.
Right.
And so they are, I don't want to say they're complicating it, they're actually getting people to quickly surrender to this idea that there's nothing we can do. This is legitimate. That we can't undo this.
Well, then what happens is, they have what they think is another solution, but it takes people out of the fight.
Absolutely. Literally. It's the same thing with secession. If a state secedes right now because the federal government is violating the Constitution, if they secede now, then, that's one state that can't stand up. I mean, that state has to come back, has to request to be admitted back into the Union. And it takes away our strength in numbers. We need strength in numbers.
Well, we do. And the other thing, if a state goes off on its own, then it's really off on its own. I mean, it's a nation unto itself. I mean, imagine what could happen to a state if it were off on its own and then they get slammed by the other nations. I mean, the other nations were waiting to carve us up before the framers came up with the Constitution. And in fact, who was it that said, was it Massachusetts that said, hey, we can do it this by ourselves?
Yep.
Right?
Yep. It was Massachusetts that said that during the ratification debates. Let the other states ratify this. We'll stay out of it.
Right. Yeah. We can handle this by ourselves. I don't think that'll last it long.
No. And as a matter of fact, look at what happened to Massachusetts today. I mean, Massachusetts is you know, gone bonkos on liberalism and communism. I mean, just wow. Anyway, so moving on, let's go ahead and read that statement, 84, 85, and just keep going from there.
Oh, sure. Okay. 84. Such is the political system of the United States de jure and de facto. And however it may be obscured by the ingenuity and technicalities of controversial commentators, its true character will be sustained by an appeal to the law and the testimony of the Fundamental Charter.
Now, what he's meaning, the Fundamental Charter is the Constitution. Right. It's just another word for it. Right.
Whereas a system formed by the people as one community would, on its dissolution, throw the people into a state. What does he mean by this?
Well, I mean, when you dissolve, when you dissolve the Union, we're no longer a one people, one community. We get, you know, we literally land in autonomous, independent, and separate states.
Sure.
Right.
86. A just inference from a survey of this political system is that it is a division and distribution of political power. Nowhere else to be found a nondescript to be tested and experienced by itself alone, and that it happily illustrates the diversified moderations of which the representative principle of republicanism is susceptible with a view to the conditions, opinions, and habits of particular communities. Okay. Uh-huh. Every one of these needs explanation. I'm sorry, Jared.
Okay, so let's take it one step at a time. Okay. Just an inference from a survey, from analyzing this political system, is that it is a division and distribution of political power nowhere else found, a nondescript to be tested and experienced by itself alone. What he's saying here is that this system is distributive. It's political power. Like we talked about this, centripetal and centrifugal. This political system allows the majority of all of the energy to flow closest to the people, where every other government, even back then and today, is centralizing power. We make the decisions. We make all decisions. Now, even though the federal government is making all decisions, they do not have the authority to make all those decisions.
Right.
And technically, your state doesn't even have the authority to make that many decisions.
Well, but, you know, this is interesting. Wasn't it Madison who said that the federal government is limited and defined, and the states are unlimited and undefined? Remember that line?
Yes, that was in the Federalist Papers. I think it's something like Federalist 45, something
sure.
like that.
Sure, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So he seemed to express, and you know, yesterday we talked about how he didn't consider the counties.
Yeah, okay? I brought that up, yes.
All right, but he seemed to express that the difference between, you know, the federal and the states was that the states were in charge.
Right, okay.
You know? Yeah. So they could pretty much do, I mean, what they wanted as sovereign states as long as they followed the Constitution.
Okay. So the second part of this, it happily illustrates this form of government happily illustrates the diversified moderations of, in other words, the diversified moderations of how these representative principles of republicanism is susceptible in all these different conditions and opinions and habits and particular communities. In other words, we're actually, even though we're a union, we're going to actually see states diverge in what they think is important because right. they have that power. It is not vested in the central government. We don't have a central government. We have a limited and defined services government. It's basically just there to provide specific services.
Right.
So, okay. So this all makes sense now.
Okay.
All right. Okay.
All right. 86. A just
87. 87, right?
You're right.
All right.
That a sovereignty should have even been denied to the states in their united character may well excite wonder when it is recollected that the Constitution which now unites them was announced by the convention which formed it as dividing sovereignty between the Union and the states. See the letter of President Washington to the convention to the old Congress.
Right.
That it was presented under that view by contemporary expositions recommending it to the ratifying authorities. See better something and other proof. Probably maybe Federalist Papers. I don't know. That it is proved to have been so understood by the language which has been applied to it constantly and notoriously that this has been the doctrine and language until a very late date even by those who now take the lead in making a denial of it the basis of the novel notion of nullification. See the report to the legislature of South Carolina in 1828. So familiar as a sovereignty in the U.S. to the thoughts, views, and opinions even of its polemic adversaries that Mr. Rowan, in his elaborate speech in support of the indivisibility of sovereignty, relapsed before the conclusion of his argument into the idea that sovereignty was partly in the Union, partly in the states, see his speech in the Richmond Inquirer, of the other champions of the rights of the states, among them Mr. Jefferson, might be appealed to as bearing testimony to the sovereignty of the United States. If Burr had been convicted of acts defined to be treason, which it is allowed can be commuted only against a sovereign authority, who would then have pleaded the want of sovereignty in the United States? I don't know what that is.
Probably query.
Query, if there be no sovereignty in the U.S., whether the crimes denominated treason might be committed without falling within the jurisdiction of the states and consequently with impunity. Again, another mouthful. What I need to ask is, did I miss something about Aaron Burr being convicted of acts?
No. He said, had Aaron Burr been convicted.
Of what?
Of treason.
Okay.
So Aaron Burr was charged with treason and was tried down, I think it was in Norfolk, Virginia. That's where John Marshall went down to actually try it. He tried to commit treason in Louisiana prior to Louisiana becoming a state. He tried to get them as a part of the territory to actually abandon the United States and establish their own government.
Aaron Burr attempted, I probably missed that.
Yeah.
Aaron Burr attempted to have Louisiana establish their own government.
Yeah, this was after he killed Hamilton.
Okay.
Yeah, so he does the nation a favor, and then he goes and commits treason. Yeah.
Okay.
See, at this point in time, I think Burr was, if you remember correctly, Burr had been the vice president, and then after Burr, it was Clinton.
Okay.
And both were, I believe, leaders within the New York State. I mean, Clinton was the governor during the ratification of the Constitution, and Burr, I know, was a lawyer and, you know, popular politician. So
wasn't Burr vice president during Jefferson's time?
Yeah, his first term.
The first term? Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
All right. So where are we now?
88.
Okay. What seems to be an obvious and indefensible proof that the people of the individual states as composing the United States must possess a sovereignty, at least in relation to foreign sovereigns, is that in that supposition only, foreign sovereigns would be willing or expected to maintain international relations with the United States. Let it be understood that the government at Washington was not a national government representing a sovereign authority.
Right. And that sovereignty
resided absolutely and exclusively in the several states. As the only sovereigns and nations in our political system. He uses that term nations again.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And diplomatic functionaries at the seat of the federal government would be obliged to close their communications with the Secretary of State and with new commissions, repair to Columbia, South Carolina, and other seats of the state's governments. Okay. He brings up South Carolina again.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
No, that's what this is all about, right?
All right.
Okay.
Okay. That they could no longer, as the representatives of a sovereign authority, hold intercourse with a functionary who was but an agent of a self-called government, which was itself but an agent representing no sovereign authority, not that of the United States as separate sovereignties, nor a sovereignty in the United States. For a like reason, the plenipotentiaries of the United States at foreign courts would be obliged to return home unless commissioned by the individual states. With respect to foreign nations, the Confederacy of the States, and he has Confederacy in quotes, was held de facto to be a nation, or other nations would not have held national relations with it.
Uh-huh.
This was a tongue twister.
Okay, so keep in mind that what he's really doing is he's still going down John C. Calhoun's logic of how he's claiming that the federal government isn't sovereign. See, previously he already identified that the sovereign states created and delegated sovereignty to the general government, to the federal government.
Some sovereignty. Limited.
Whatever they delegated that sovereignty, specific sovereignty, over
right.
war, over trade, over these very specific things.
Oh, right,
and so this right here, he's basically saying, well, you know, if one looks at what Calhoun is talking about, you know, that the states are the sovereigns and that the federal government isn't sovereign. And that
He's speaking here also of relations with foreign nations.
Yes.
All right.
Right.
And he's really mixing up this language again. Okay.
Who, Madison?
Yeah, sure. I mean.
Yeah. So I admit, because, you know, this is not the first time or the second time I've read through this. And
right.
I quickly admit, when you read this, I still to this day, I get lost at where he's at. Is he actually speaking trying to create the logic of how Calhoun is presenting his argument? That's exactly what he's doing here. So there's these points where you go, you know, he should be just arguing against it. But the beautiful thing that really comes out from Madison here is he actually takes a stand of how, you know, they're justifying it and how wrong their justifications are. It's kind of like when you look at the Monroe veto statement compared to Madison's veto statement regarding the Department of Transportation. Monroe actually puts the justifications that Congress had included in their, you know, we justify this bill because of the Commerce Clause, because of the General Welfare and Defense Clause, because of the, you know, establishing post roads and blah, blah, blah. And so all these six or seven, you know, justifications that they attempted to, you know, get this bill passed. And Monroe basically said, even if you combined all of your justification together, that power doesn't exist in all of them combined.
right.
You have to amend the Constitution. There's no way about this. You've got to amend it. So anyway, what he's really doing here is he's basically saying that, you know, he's pointing out the real flaws of his logic.
Okay.
Of John C. Calhoun and South Carolina's logic, because that's what he's focused on, is that they've created this logic. Because he even pointed to it a paragraph or two above where he said, see the South Carolina, you know, in 1828. Right.
Okay.
Right. So all 89.
Right. So we're at 89. The more the political system of the United States is fairly examined, the more necessary it will be found to abandon the abstract and technical modes of expounding and designing its character.
Designating,
thank you. And to view it as laid down in the charter which constitutes it, as a system hitherto without a model, as neither a simple or consolidated government, nor a government altogether confederate, and therefore not to be so explained, as to make it either, but to be explained and designated according to the actual division and distribution of political power on the face of the instrument. So I think one of the things he's saying here is this is like no other government that's ever been made.
That's right. But he kind of, what he says in the very last, and designed according to the actual division and distribution of political power on the face of the instrument. That instrument is the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. There is one view of the subject which ought to have its influence on those who espouse doctrines which strike at the authoritative origin and efficacious operation of the government of the United States. The government of the United States, like all governments, free in their principles, rests on compact, a compact not between the government and the parties who formed and live under it, but among the parties themselves. And the strongest of governments are those in which the compacts were most fairly formed and most faithfully executed. Now, you highlighted this.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, that's maybe there. Well, that's what he's basically, this last part right here, or I should say it's actually in the middle. The government of the United States, like all governments free in their principles, rest on compact. A compact not between the government and the parties who formed it and live under it, but among the parties themselves. And the strongest of governments are those in which compacts are most fairly and formed and most faithfully executed. So in other words, it's kind of a, you know, this last little "and faithfully executed" is poking South Carolina in the eye, because they're not faithfully executing it. They're not following along in unison as a part of the union. They want to break away because it's an inconvenience, or, you know, and instead what they should have done was they should have done what Virginia and Kentucky did by basically calling for the states to join an interposition. Here's sure. The reality. What was really happening, and this is the beginning. So 1828. Mm-hmm. Now, let's just take a quick aside. Let's take a quick aside here.
Okay.
I've said and said and said that the Constitution was destroying the ability for slavery to persist in this country.
Okay.
And the proof of that was the Missouri Compromise, because they had to do something to bypass what was happening via that compact.
Okay.
And I told you that even though the states, the Senate may have, you know, some equal proportion, but eventually more and more states would end up joining the Union, like would New Mexico. Mm-hmm. With Colorado. I mean, these are not agrarian states. They may be rancher states, but mm-hmm. can you see slavery? I mean, if you don't have the ability to have an agrarian crop production plantation,
mm-hmm.
then
slavery doesn't have a lot of value.
There you go. Because we'll set up a factory and have slaves in our factory, you know, and that becomes problematic.
So what the South is seeing is that new states are not going to be supportive of this way of life.
So, as you see things moving on, in 1828, the North was actually creating political pressures, because they said, okay, you got your Missouri Compromise, here's our response to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they basically began punishing the South for maintaining slavery. And for, you know, this perpetuation of slavery along these boundaries. And so, rightfully so, in 1828, they could have nullified and they should have severed their relationship with the Union. That's what they should have done. Instead of waiting and waiting and trying to get basically this insurrection. We're going into a break here. So they're going to execute this insurrection, and this insurrection against the Constitution, because actually it wasn't even an insurrection. They said, we're getting out of this. We're going to take our slaves, and we're going to be happy with what we have. And, you know, in looking at what could have happened and the direction that they could have gone, I'm just saying, you know, this actually just proves the theory of the Constitution. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Yeah, so it's kind of difficult with, you know, really something more to say and you just don't have enough time to say it. So the design of the Constitution, as a matter of fact, in the Pennsylvania ratification debates, the Massachusetts ratification debates, and I think there was at least another ratification debate that actually spoke to the fact that this Constitution was going to get rid of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And the southern states thought that it was going to protect them. And so here's the question. Who was right? Well, why is it that the southern states had to basically, you know, create this unconstitutional compromise, you know,
right,
and force states to come into the Union as slave states? If it was actually going to preserve it, then they shouldn't have had to do anything.
So you said just before the break, hey, South Carolina should have seceded.
They should have seceded at this point instead of waiting until 1860. And instead, they tried, you know, they used political, I'll just say money, affluence, and all these other things to try to create extra compromises and so forth. And I think what really ended up happening is it allowed our system to kind of become more corrupt.
Okay.
Because it gave Britain time to, you know, really penetrate, you know, America with more agents and so forth. Because, I mean, we allowed anybody and everybody to migrate here.
Okay.
Right?
Well, sure.
And many of them
we were inviting.
Yeah. And many of them just became citizens.
Okay.
So as I look at it, I see how, you know, what's going on here, the pressures were on, right? I mean, in other words, a reciprocation for what the South was able to get away with the Missouri Compromise. There were people in the North that didn't like it, and as the tide in Congress changed again, because mm-hmm. when people realized, hey, you know, this guy from Connecticut voted for that Missouri Compromise. How dare you? And so the abolition movement really started forming under John Quincy Adams.
Right.
And okay. So that's when there was, and John Quincy Adams, when he went into the Senate, he served the rest of his life as an abolitionist driving for the end of slavery.
Now, let me see. John Quincy Adams, I think was he the only president to just turn right around and run for
and serve a as office? A senator or as a different office? Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So
and was a hardline abolitionist.
Yeah, and you can tell. I mean, back in those days, it was men of principle. You know, when we look today, I mean, it's not like we've had many of them since then. But you know, term limits would have made that impossible.
Yes, right.
So, and obviously he was proving his case as representing the state of Massachusetts and fighting. But mm-hmm. what ended up happening was the parties started getting more and more organized. And I kind of show that through, you know, this history of the Electoral College.
I think they were getting more and more belligerent to each other. Right?
The North and South, the abolitionists and the slave. Yeah, they were. But here's the interesting thing. It was still a minority in the South.
What do you mean?
The only people that actually could afford slaves and had slaves, as Thomas Sowell points out, were the big plantations.
Right.
I mean, you know, some families just struggled to be able to maintain and take care of one or two slaves. So, you know, some families were actually losing them because they had to sell them just so they could, you know, feed themselves right. or what have you. They became more and more poor.
That's interesting. There is also, you may know more about this. I should have researched this, and this is kind of an aside for a minute. And maybe Thomas Sowell has something to say about this. I know my dad did, okay? In fact, I think we have relatives that were black slave owners.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Louisiana had I want to say the slave ownership was something, black slave ownership was something in the neighborhood of 30%, 40, something like that. It was pretty high.
That's significant.
Yeah.
I would like to find the documentation for that. I've heard that. I've not found it, but that is significant for it to be 30%.
Uh-huh.
Wow. You know, I'm just wondering how they got away with that.
Right. Well, so Louisiana came in from, it was France, right? So there were probably a lot of, in Louisiana, they didn't probably have big plantations because, you know, supposedly the French, you know, as a matter of fact, New Orleans was originally what country created and founded that city? Because it wasn't New Orleans originally.
It wasn't?
No.
Then I don't remember.
Spain.
Okay.
So Spain actually conquered that area. And, you know, Portugal and Spain were conquering, you know, the North America prior to France and England.
And
so, right. And so they were doing the South because, you know, it was far more tropical and far more conducive. When they looked at North America, it's too barren. There's no gold up there to confiscate.
Right.
So, I mean, they were looking at robbing and taking advantage. And they go, well, if nobody else wants to live there, why would we?
Yeah, so, yeah, they wanted to take gold back to the mother country.
Right.
Gold was a big thing.
Right, and so they found merit in basically setting up camp at the mouth of the Mississippi.
Okay.
And ended up, I think, being bought by France. And so New Orleans, France ended up basically calling it New Orleans, and it really became a French town.
Right.
Right. And so as France, you know, was getting in need for money because, you know, we were actually paying our debt, but that still wasn't enough because Napoleon wanted Europe. And so...
Right.
He needed some money to do that, and this sale of the Louisiana Territory, which France had claim, and he knew that it was inevitable. There's no way he could have defended this much land over here. Just no way.
Yeah, okay.
They already saw Britain lose to, you know, these scrappy colonists. And twice they saw Britain. Well, actually, they didn't see the second time. But nevertheless, when we bought the Louisiana Territory, that actually then it became this small city, or I should say a good city that had a lot of extra land to it. Plantations really hadn't been set up there yet. And as they started coming in, you know, people that were there that had money, who were freemen, bought up a lot of land and ended up buying slaves to basically
do the work. Right?
There you go. And the slave trade was open until 1808.
Okay. According to the Constitution, it was open until 1808.
Correct. It was open. And so Louisiana was in the United States for 5 years while everybody was basically doing land prospecting and trying to create up or set up plantations.
Okay.
You see, it became a franchise of those who have the most money can actually buy more land. And it's not about just money. It's about children. So these large, it's about children. So when you have a large family, you can then give money to your children to go buy land and create a plantation there.
Right.
And
well,
families
were economic units.
Yes, they were. Absolutely. Right. And so these plantations started developing this, I'll just call it a franchise. And that's what they were doing.
Okay.
So nevertheless, let's get back to 91. And this is what you were kind of going through.
Okay. Now, all must agree that the compact in the case of the United States was duly formed and by a competent authority. It was formed, in fact, by the people of the several states in their highest sovereign authority, an authority which could have made the compact a mere league or a consolidated of all entirely into one community. Such was their authority, if such had been their will. It was their will to prefer to either the constitutional government now existing and this being undeniably established by a competent and even the highest human authority, it follows that the obligation to give it all the effect to which any government could be entitled, whatever the mode of its formation, is equally undeniable. Had it been formed by the people of the United States as one society, the authority could not have been more competent than that which did form it, nor would a consolidation of the people of the states into one people be different in validity or operation if made by the aggregate authority of the people of the states than if made by the plenary sanction, if given concurrently as it was in their highest sovereign capacity. I want to pause here.
Yeah.
Essentially, it sounds like he's saying whatever the people would have decided, they had the authority and the
Go up a little bit. Yeah, because such was their authority, right? So, you know, here was a group in a sovereign authority, and he goes on and he says, such was their authority. If such had been their will, it would actually, maybe I need to go up further. So we'll say, okay, so yeah, let's go up a little further.
Okay.
That the compact in the case of the United States was duly formed and by a competent authority. It was formed, in fact, by the people of the several states in their highest sovereign authority. In other words, did all the people descend upon Philadelphia for this convention?
No.
No. They elected delegates to go to that convention to form a government that was necessary to make, you know, to basically take the Articles of Federation and create a general government that could sufficiently support and efficaciously support these sovereign states.
So they delegated sovereignty.
Yes. So that's why they, in their highest sovereign authority, in a republican form of government, that's how it is done.
Okay.
Okay. And so you have to keep in mind when he's talking about authority, he's talking about representatives who have this given power. Remember, we went through those commissions for the delegates.
Okay.
The delegates not have the full authority to do what they deemed necessary to save the Union?
Yes, they did.
Okay. So did they not have the highest authority, given to them, or the highest sovereignty?
Sure.
Okay. So there you go. So in that authority, they went and created this, and even though they're using the term it being done in the name of the people, it was the people's representatives.
Okay.
And so most people, when they read this, they really think, because Madison is saying, yes, it is the people. It is their representatives. They gave them the commission. They said, go do this. And they did.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
And so, but when he goes on, let me ask, because I want to make sure I or the audience have this clearly. Mm-hmm. It almost sounds like he's saying whatever the people would have. How should I put delegated their representatives to do, they had the authority from the people to do it.
Yes.
That's what's done. Okay.
Yes.
All right. And it just happened.
It goes back to that commission. They actually had blank checks.
Okay.
Even though going in, everybody knew there was only two states. We talked about this. There was only two states that had little hooks in it that said, don't touch this part.
Okay.
Right. And so right. by the spirit of what they did and what they created, they abided by that. But the point is that, you know, they walked in there with very specific view of all of these different problems. And the problems created such a complex, I'll just say, created such a complex problem in trying to fix the Articles of Confederation that they had to reorganize it. And in that process of reorganizing, they saw the necessity and the advantage of dividing the sovereignty of Congress, because remember, the Articles of Confederation and the general government at that time was a single legislative body. They had right. no judiciary. They had no executive. And so they saw the, I'll just say, you know, the heavens part and see how much better it would be to separate the power. So when you hear separation of powers, what that means is that this sovereignty has been divided and conquered.
Okay.
Because now you have a judiciary that does just that. And now you have an executive that executes the law, and that's all. And now you have a sovereign body of legislatures who create the laws and change the laws.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, what they ended up doing was they literally made these wholesale changes as they saw fit to make this system work. And when you look at what, I mean, they created a judiciary and gave the general government more power and authority. But if not, had they not done that, then because the judiciary in itself was a problem. If you read the jurisdiction, the judicial jurisdiction of the Articles of Confederation and the Continental Congress, I mean, they would have to, every time there was a need, they would have to appoint a judge and then they would have to, you know, determine whether that was right or not. I mean, it was almost like they had no power at all.
Yes. Right.
And so they basically had to make sure that the judiciary had the power and jurisdiction over all things arising under that Constitution, but nothing more. They Correct. Couldn't creep into the state's knickers. They couldn't creep into international knickers unless it was something that was affecting them.
Right.
Right. So anyway.
Okay. Did I finish this paragraph, or did I
No,
stop?
You didn't. And actually, so you're right in here, made by the aggregate authority of the people of the states, than if made by the plenary sanction. So you went, and okay. I think it's the government is where you left off.
All right. So if given concurrently, as it was in their highest sovereign authority, right, the government, whatever it be, resulting from either of these processes would rest on an authority equally competent and be equally obligatory and operative on those over whom it was established, nor would it be in any respect less responsible theoretically and practically to the constituent body in the one hypothesis than in the other, or less subject in extreme cases to be resisted and overthrown, the faith pledged in the compact being the vital principle of all free governments. That is the true test of which political right and wrong are to be decided, and the resort to physical force justified whether applied to the enforcement or the subversion of political power.
Now remember that the federal government does not have a standing army. And
right.
at this point in time, it had no ability to defend itself. As a matter of fact, if the states really felt that they got that far out of whack, they had the militia to be able to go straighten them out.
Right.
And at this point in time, that was sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is, as things kept going and as the government became more and more corrupt, we needed a different tool.
Okay.
We needed a tool to be able to hold our government accountable, not by the by deadly force, but by using legal and political force.
Okay.
And so the 14th Amendment, Section 3, gave us the legal and political force of holding our government accountable that was lacking in the Constitution prior.
And, you know, after it, let's see. It's interesting. I had thought that after the 14th Amendment, when was that? I had thought that after the 14th Amendment, that it had been baked into the Missouri Constitution, but I think the Missouri Constitution had it first.
You have to look at the history of that. I will. Yeah, because I honestly think that many states had redone their constitutions several times.
And Missouri has.
Yeah.
But what we did, Missouri baked that in to the Constitution.
Yeah, yeah. And South, I want to say Iowa did, but I don't think they did. I know South Dakota did.
Yeah, okay.
So
anyway. All right, so we're in 92, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Whatever be the mode in which the essential authority established the Constitution, the structure of this, the powers of this, the rules of exposition, the means of execution must be the same. The tendency to
consolidation
or dissolution, yeah. Dissolution the same.
Uh-huh.
The question whether we the people means the people in their aggregate capacity acting by a numerical majority of the whole or by a majority in each of all the states, the authority being equally valid and binding, but a particular fact, the question is merely speculative. Whether the centripetal or centrifugal tendency
greatest
is a problem which experience is to decide and depends not on the mode and effect of the powers granted. The only distinctive circumstance is the effect of.
Okay.
Oh, so, the effect of.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. So, but he uses those two words, centripetal and centrifugal.
Right.
So, in other words, is it outward flowing or is it drawing to the center? Is it pulling in for the controls? Because
right.
pulling in is centralizing so that the central government makes all the decisions. If it says, you know, all things that we don't have, we don't draw in are left for you. Everything else is left for you, which means that the residual is left for the states, and actually the residual is left to the counties, and I wish he would have had the foresight to include counties here.
Well, we're going to have to do that.
Right. Well, obviously, because, you know, because the same argument that he's creating, that the states have this authority as parties to the compact, the counties are the parties to the compact of all the states.
Yes, they are. I mean, sure. I mean, that's what happened in actuality. It just wasn't caught or
right.
recognized or pointed out.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So we're on the last two. I don't know if we'll make it, but we'll see what we can do.
We'll probably get this one done. Go ahead.
93. In conclusion, those who deny the possibility of a political system with a divided sovereignty like that of the United States must choose between a government purely consolidated and an association of governments purely federal.
Okay, hold on here. So
okay.
He's talking about, in conclusion, those who deny the possibility of a political system with a divided sovereignty.
Right.
In other words, that's how our system is. We have divided sovereignty.
Right.
Where, as North Carolina was making the assertion a few paragraphs up today, you know, they were basically saying, no, the states are sovereign of everything. You know, that there is no power delegated to the general government. That's not true.
Mm-hmm.
There are very specific powers, and only those powers do they have sovereignty over. All things the state. So we have this divided sovereignty. But the one thing, again, this goes back to, I wish Madison would have, included the tri-level sovereignty, that even the states themselves have limited sovereignty, that the true residual mass resides with the people in their counties, because that actually is the closest thing to actual representative government of the people of their community, because the counties really is the closest thing to a community that we have. Because he talks about, and he uses the word community, that all of the states joined this community of the union. It's the same thing with the counties. Now, you can literally see on a coastal state how you have diverging interests from seagoing resources and ports and those types of things, from mountains and forests and minerals and you know, fields and so forth, where, you know, the focus of the land on the interior is a lot different and more, you know, differently focused than the focus of the coastal counties and the and the counties that have rivers going through them, because those were a means of transportation and flowing of commerce downstream to the port, upstream to the people. And so, you know, they were natural highways back in those days, especially the slow-moving rivers. And so as we look at this republic, this same model that the federal and state level was based upon is applicable to the counties in the state as well. Whether that was actually recognized by these guys, because I'm saying it wasn't, there's no doubt the divine hand of providence did. He truly understood, which is why they fell backwards into this concept of having the counties set up the constitutions and set up the states. It wasn't by, and actually it wasn't by accident.
Right.
I believe it was by design and or by providential inspiration.
Okay. I agree.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Think I can get this paragraph done in a minute 12?
Probably not, but if why don't we leave it here? We'll just pick up 93 again. I'm sorry for going off on a little rant, but there's no way you would have gotten it done anyway.
Yeah, I don't.
Because you would have had questions and so forth. Even though he's concluding, there would still be stuff that we really want to do, and we would need to kind of close out this. And I hate to just you finish and then us jump on to the next topic.
Right.
So, it's best that we do that. Now, once we're done with this, then we're going to kind of talk in the next episode. So we have basically, so tomorrow's Tuesday. So we have Wednesday and Thursday to discuss Republic Review and how to use the counties to initiate this movement in pushing the states into this interposition, into forcing the federal government into compliance.
Right.
As I mean, as this starts going forward and as people start gaining, you know, this understanding, it becomes easier and easier. Believe me, it's just putting the brain matter to this. So folks, thank you, Paul, for joining us. Folks, again, as I just said, it takes the brain matter. You just have to apply some thought and a little bit of time to connect the dots. This is not rocket science. This is clearly the way forward, as Madison is selling in her position in this last document. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.